Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute.
Today we're talking about how to build a responsible and just cannabis industry, and we are joined by the co-founders of Cannabis Doing Good and the Cannabis Impact Fund, Kelly Perez and Courtney Mathis. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Eric. We're glad to be here.
Well, this is a very, very important topic and one that we've covered a little bit on the show previously, but I'm very excited for the conversation to learn about the work that you're doing, and particularly because you're operating here in Colorado. I believe you're both in Colorado. So you've had a chance to really watch the legal cannabis industry evolve over the last 6 years. And before we really get to a conversation about where the industry is going and whether or not it is really fulfilling its promise, I guess, of meeting social equity standards and doing right and being a just industry, I want to focus a little bit on both of your backgrounds, your personal stories that got you to where you are involved with the excellent work that you're doing with these organizations. So I'll let Courtney go first. Just give us a sense of how you got started.
Yeah, how we got started in cannabis.
Or even before that. You know, a lot of the times people have, people get involved in this industry because of a personal connection with the plant or somebody in their life who has an interesting connection with the plant. So we can go back even before your involvement in the industry, if you'd like to, and if it makes sense to do so.
Sure. You know, so one of my favorite mentors always said, life is like a lattice on the ladder. And that is particularly true in cannabis because we all come from such varying walks of life. And in a previous life, I was actually a marine researcher and worked with bottlenose dolphins and orcas. But for a bulk of my career, I've really been in nonprofit consulting. And I've been in Denver about 12 years. And when I first got here, I started a master's program at Regis in nonprofit consulting or nonprofit management, and was really learning all the ins and outs of how to run a nonprofit business. I was particularly interested in this as I'd come from research and really caring a lot about environmental sustainability and about our earth, and realized that research was going way too slow. And I thought I was going to have this huge splash by getting into the nonprofit sector and basically saving our planet as sort of the young idealist that I was. Fast forward to being in my master's program, I quickly got hooked up with sort of a grandfather of nonprofits in cannabis by the name of Richard Mayle. And his name is Rich Mayle. So Kelly and I, I'll let Kelly tell that part of the story, I actually met through a Rich Mayle, even though he wasn't rich, but he was a totally lovely guy. And worked with him for years. And we were actually incubating a nonprofit at the time. It was Denver Comic Con. And I have a long history of loving everything comics and manga, and consider myself a super nerd, and was working with Denver Comic Con on some of their programs. And they, years ago, were looking for funding for a specific program of theirs where they were working on implementing a comic creative literacy program in jails as a way for inmates to be able to process their trauma and tell their story. And they were looking for funding. And about that time, the recreational adult use cannabis market was coming online. And I sort of said to myself, okay, there's this really vulnerable industry emerging, which was the cannabis industry. And there's this really vulnerable and courageous nonprofit, Denver Comic Con, working to support what is an even more vulnerable population, which was our inmates in jail. And I wanted to find a way for them to collaborate. So I was really working at trying to sort out, how do we break down barriers between this nonprofit industry and the cannabis industry as a way for them to collaborate and support one another? What is the demystification that needs to happen, and the red tape of working with boards, which are always very complicated and sometimes slow? What are the cultural nuances that we need to take into consideration? I was really working on figuring that out. And at the time, was just actively reaching out to cannabis companies, almost cold calling them, frankly, to figure out, hey, would you be willing to support this program? And so the reason that I thought that the industry was so such a good target for this partnership was we were working in inner city jails. And I thought, you know, obviously, given cannabis's history with the drug war, it felt like a very synchronous partnership. But of course, I ran into lots of bumps along the way. However, one happy thing that occurred was my introduction to Kelly and throughout that process. So I'll let Kelly tell her story.
It's so cool. We didn't even know each other. We've been in business 6 years together. So I came from Governor Hickenlooper's administration as a policy advisor, brought there to help create the Office of Early Childhood. I come from early childhood, health equity, health policy, public health. And I could see the Amendment 64 process, which was a good process after the People's Initiative. But I could also see that there was nothing planned after it. And I, you know, read the implementing legislation and thought, how's this going to happen? And so made a pitch for, because it was keeping me up at night, made a pitch for the Office of Marijuana, the first Office of Marijuana Coordination in the world, to make sure that the departments that were responsible for things indicated in the legislation would do it. And it was real big cultural problem. I mean, public safety had no interest in doing it. The governor didn't have any interest in doing it. But I ran around saying, okay, here's what the front page of the New York Times is going to say, governor, you don't do a great job here. And it's the People's Initiative. I didn't out myself as a consumer or anyone that had a special interest in cannabis. What I cared about was the war on drugs, mass incarceration, and our laws said nothing about those things, which was, you know, really big missed opportunity, but it was hard for folks to see forward so much time. So the folks that were at the table for the creation of the Amendment 64, they certainly had in mind, a couple of people had in mind decreasing arrests, right? They definitely were thinking about over-policing the community. But we made so many mistakes in the way that the policy rolled out because we created such a high threshold for people to participate that we, in fact, eliminated anyone who came from a community that was over-policed, Black and brown people. So it was a very difficult space to get in, even if you'd been there for a while. We had, a couple of Black and brown people that got through, but when you think of, a Wanda James, she had White House clearance, she was a naval officer, she had successful entrepreneurial career before. So I could see also in the legislation, this is local. And so I went over to Denver and I was like, hey guys, we need a common conversation through public health and human services. And the way we talk about this in a website so people can know the law, say this isn't actually even work. So that's kind of where we came from. And I wanted to figure out how could community benefit from what looks to me like a hyper-local industry, even when the state says yes, the local municipalities figure it out. Over time, trying to figure out how to benefit community, knowing the local health collaborations, working already on health issues. Courtney and I, did some introductions and some open tables with cannabis companies and community members, really feeling like they were being taken advantage of, to try to level the information and playing field table to say, I know you think you're being taken advantage of communities because you are in these places that were redlined. You're in these places that are disproportionately negatively impacted by policies like alcohol. But these companies weren't the ones who did this. They're just trying to take advantage of the business opportunity. So over time, we crafted cannabis social responsibility, our own kind of take on CSR, what it looks like in cannabis, racial equity, environmental sustainability, and community benefit, and then really talked to cannabis companies about how does this meet their needs? And that's what we've continued to do for 6 years. How do we benefit the community, help a company do well, become an asset in the community, and then continuously improve. And we've done, lots of iterations of that. So that's the quick story.
And I really appreciate you kind of walking us through that. And just to go back for a moment, I thought that was funny, Courtney, when you said you started out in the marine biology field studying dolphins. That's the interesting thing and the funny thing. We've had all these conversations with folks in this industry, and it is amazing to see the just incredible backgrounds, the incredible walks of life, and the diversity in this industry that is here now. And, coming back to the work that you've done over the last 6 years, Colorado really has been an experiment for success. It was kind of the first, the first recreational market that was opened up. So I want to focus for a moment before we talk about these other states that have legalized that have put maybe a little more emphasis in their policy on social equity. I want to talk about Colorado because I know last October, in the wake of kind of a reminder, I would say, in our society last year here in the U.S. that there are still major racial and social injustices occurring in this country. We saw a response to that. We saw here in Colorado, Jared Polis mass pardon about 2,000 to 3,000 marijuana convictions. So I want to talk about how you mentioned, you know, early on in the legal market here in Colorado, there really wasn't an emphasis put on social equity programs or expungement or figuring out how to make sure that communities that were really affected by drug policy were participating meaningfully in this new industry. I want to ask if, you know, how you think that's changed. Maybe it hasn't changed enough, but walk us through, if you would, just some of the initiatives you've seen here in Colorado, perhaps been a part of and helped spur over the last 6 years.
Yeah, I wish our history wasn't that long, Eric, but we have been at the table as volunteers since the beginning of that. We've been pushing racial equity, racial justice, and once our laws were sunsetting, we pulled together right away, like, who has an interest here? How do we figure this out? How do we move it forward? And so the result, what you just referenced, HB, I think 1424, that was, you know, finally we had a social equity definition. But, you know, and we've had iterations and we're pleased for that, but the opportunity has been lost to have an entry point. So yes, we're figuring out how to have transporter and social and hospitality and delivery licenses, but those are, you know, those are pennies on the dollar to compare with folks who actually are kind of the oligarchs of industry because they had a head start. And that's the thing about racial equity, right? Is that we don't all start from the same point. So the point of social equity policy is a retrofit on policy that was incorrectly crafted, not horribly, it was within the bounds of what exists, but we don't have a lot of liberatory policy, right, at all in any sector. So we only know what you know. And there were some problems in the law as it stood. You know, had I been at the table, and I'm not the smartest person in the world, but I would have said, hey, guys, guess what? Liquor policy is also completely racialized and extractive in communities, and it has been. That's why we have food deserts. That's why we, you know, have so much lacking community. So have we made progress? We have, because we're talking about this, and we're talking about it every day. But the reason why Courtney and I got into this was always about racial equity and justice and benefiting community. So how do we figure out how to do that? And we think policy absolutely necessary and absolutely insufficient to make the change that we seek. It's cultural. So have we done a good job in terms of our regulatory framework? It depends what your aim was. Have we been copied a million times? Yes, because it functionally works. But does it make things right? It doesn't. And we're trying to fix that in policy. So what Courtney and I are trying to do with Cannabis Impact Fund and the anti-racism trainings that we do to accompany it is try to create a framework of active anti-racism in companies, because the only place you do social equity it's not just for social equity applicants. It's policy to create opportunities for racial equity. There's a lot of ways you can do that. You don't have to be a social equity applicant to do that. You know, benefiting the social determinants of health in communities impacted by policies that weaponize cannabis, that's that too. There's so many different ways to think about it. Is Colorado making progress? I guess we'll have to look at the metrics. I mean, we just started collecting them. They weren't even used. And that's the start, to actually look at the picture, treasure what you measure, measure what you treasure what you measure, and make some real aims and systematic ways to get there, which is what we try to do. Courtney, you want to add anything?
No, I think that was great.
Let's talk about some of the newer markets that have legalized recently. Thinking, of course, about Illinois, which seemingly, and I think, you know, your comments are poignant as it relates to almost the limitations of policy, in a sense, in achieving some kind of greater social equity. I really liked what you said about that this is really a cultural change, and enacting that change culturally is actually a very challenging thing, and highlights, you know, the value and importance of the work that you're doing. But I'm interested in your thoughts with the Illinois rollout compared to Colorado. And then, you know, we've also seen some headlines that are saying that the model that's being put out in New York may even be a better model than we've seen in Illinois. Obviously, you know, time will tell. But I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
oh boy, Lord, we want it to be better. And we were, you know, part of the conversations at the very beginning discussions with community in New York. But, you know, the thing is that even when you know the policy, you don't necessarily know the why the policy is that. And folks are rather self-interested. So in Illinois, like, people went around the good intentions, right? But they're totally able to do that. Because it hasn't been kind of laid out for them. Like, this is what anti-racism is. And this is how it benefits your business. This is why you're doing the thing. And also, where's the accountability check? Like, if we haven't gotten a diverse group of people, then our policies, again, are insufficient, necessary but insufficient. So we feel like helping folks understand the why is important. And then you've got to continue fixing policy. And I don't mean to be nasty to anybody, but I haven't met a lot of regulatory folks that are thinking about how do we make cultural change. I've worked with policymakers for 20 years. People intend the right things that aren't necessarily like social scientists to get to the impact. And so there's so many things that need to be taken into account. And it is a cultural shift, but who better than us? Like, we're change makers, we're rule breakers, we push the bounds. So I think we just have to understand that there's a lot of folks in cannabis that actually do want to do the right thing, but don't know how. And we need to make sure we have accountability for the folks that are really just trying to get around the rules, that are giving somebody, hey, you know, you're Black, can I pay you to take 51% ownership, and I'm not going to give you any equity, but you can have this $40,000 salary, you know, so that we're aware that folks are absolutely trying to skip around the intent of the policy.
And I would just like to add, I think that so many social equity initiatives, and Kelly, you can tell me if you disagree or agree with this, are really hinged upon this idea around diversity. And I think what we're really trying to say when we talk about cultural change is that when we look at policy, we really, what I feel like it probably isn't happening is that it's being approached through an anti-racism lens, through a health equity lens, through a wealth generation lens. It's just kind of looking at this singular diversity component. And I think they're using diversity as a way to leverage other things around wealth generation and maybe equitable distribution of resource or licenses. But it's just not been all that effective. And I think it's because they're missing the key narrative shift there, which is that everything that we do in cannabis absolutely has to be through an anti-racism framework. And that's not easy to do. As a matter of fact, one of the things that Kelly and I say daily is that our legacy and a Cannabis Doing Good's legacy is to make the right thing the easy thing, because it's ridiculously hard, particularly when we're talking about racial equity and when we're talking about implementing anti-racism best practice, not only at the business level, but at the policy level. And I think that's a challenge, and I'm not sure we've seen anyone master it just yet.
That's an actively anti-racist white woman who is humble and always learning, which is what it takes. And it is very difficult to go from, okay, I know extraction, but I don't know a thing about racial justice. I'm just trying to jump through the hoops so that I can operate. And we get that. But cannabis has a historical context. It came off the backs of Black and brown and sick people. And so we have to try to do right with this opportunity to build a sector that is unlike any that we've seen and that has worldwide implications. And we just have to keep trying to do better, you know, not just sit where we are. Keep trying to do better and not expect perfection, but not stop. We can't stop.
Well, those are powerful points. And, you know, thinking about that comment, you treasure what you measure, it makes me think about how in a lot of policymaking decisions and conversations about who's in the room, whether this is about cannabis policy or any policy, really, at the local, state, and federal level, the kinds of people and the kinds of considerations that are really taken into account when making sweeping changes, it seems to me, or you probably always have somebody in the room who is representing, you know, a financial component, who's going to benefit from, you know, how much money is it going to cost? But, you know, these considerations really require expertise that it seems like isn't well represented in those conversations. You know, whether it's academics or community advocates, it just seems to be kind of part of a wider problem in our country, for sure, as far as who really has a seat at the conversation when making policy that is challenging to write, But as you said, we need to challenge ourselves to be better about the work that we're doing and the organizations that we're creating and the frameworks that we're allowing those organizations to exist within. I wonder if there's any projects or organizations that you're working with and through any of your endeavors that you'd really like to highlight or give a little bit of shout out to, who's really taking that pledge of being better.
Absolutely. I mean, you really did hit a lot of things on the head. I would just like to say that policy isn't just like, you know, it's not just legislation at whatever level. Policy is how your business practices. Policy is your ethical standards. Policy is a lot of stuff. It's good ideas that scale. And so we just have to admit that we have a lot more work to do. And when you see a table that's filled with just business interests or lawyers even, like what are the aims here? What are the values here? Because this is a new day. What we're seeing in corporate activism and what we were seeing, you know, prior to Mr. Floyd's killing, and Patagonia coming out, environmental injustice is racial injustice. Like, consumers are having a higher level of expectations. Our industry is so mystified, as Courtney said. It is hard for folks to know what the right thing to do is, which is why we're always trying to help companies do it. And then also make sure consumers know about it so that positive feedback loop can happen. So, I mean, Terrapin Care Station is definitely one that stands out for us as a company that is really seeking to do the right thing. Courtney, you want to say a little bit about our work with them?
Absolutely. You know, Terrapin, we've been working with Terrapin for years, and our work with them started as really rooting them and grounding them in their CSR, which their social responsibility and effort, which always had a racial justice component. But what we've seen in the last year or more from them is really the willingness to step up into the process of becoming anti-racist and not expecting perfection. And they're willing to put their brand and their business on the line to say, here's what it looks like to step into this work. And we don't expect perfection, but we are going to move towards more progress. And what that looks like is them in partnership with us facilitating an anti-racism training for all of their management staff, and also using some of that anti-racism training. One of the components we did with them specifically was around using an anti-racism framework for hiring and recruiting. We've also seen them since that training really launch an anti-racism committee, which should be, there's a quick nuance there between an anti-racism committee and a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee. Again, the DEI committees are usually entirely focused on one metric, which seems to be hiring and recruiting more BIPOC folks, whereas the Terrapin, our anti-racism committee, is absolutely rooted and grounded in creating an anti-racist and inclusive culture, so that once they get to the point where they have evolved their hiring and recruiting practices to be more racially just, that the BIPOC folks that come into their business are going to feel nurtured and supported and welcomed. And we're not just talking about hiring folks at entry-level jobs. We're talking about hiring BIPOC folks in positions of power throughout the company. We've also seen them, even during COVID, when things were scary, 100% commit to their community partners and commit to their racial justice efforts. They were original founders of the Cannabis Impact Fund, which was a huge opportunity for us and an amazing, amazing honor for us, for them to come in and help found our nonprofit, which has, you know, 5 grantees all committed to racial justice. And those are 3 outside of cannabis and 2 within cannabis. So they've done the anti-racism training. They are actively moving through what it feels like to have an anti-racism committee, which, by the way, isn't easy work. They're looking at bringing in additional facilitators and experts to help deepen their anti-racism learning, so that as a committee, they can take what they've learned and make it more accessible to everyone in their team. They've doubled down on their community engagement partners that are committed to racial justice. And they've worked really hard at looking at their marketing and communications and the language that they use and the stories that they tell to make sure that they're always being aware of their position, not only in their community, but their position in the industry and how to leverage the power that they have to uplift racial justice issues. And it's just something we're tremendously proud of.
And their turnover rate is nothing. And they are getting licenses because, you know, they're not just talking the talk, they're walking it. I'd like to put Iwana in there as well, that we started working with them ages ago. They're on their own, no training wheels. They've hired someone who's really centered on this work and are looking to see how they measure what they're doing. Like, that's very sophisticated, also imperfectly, right? So I think it's Low Cannabis Company. They are, have also trained many of their staff of real commitments around a strategy to become actively anti-racist. We have so many partners in the Cannabis Impact Fund, folks giving us 1%, brand new companies, because they want to be a part of the movement for Black lives, but it isn't easy for cannabis to do that. So we have partnerships, as Courtney said, with Color of Change, the Bail Project, Code Incubator, Minorities for Medical Marijuana, so policy to figure out how do we become a more just culture. So there's a lot of folks, again, who want to do the right thing, who know performative activism, a Black sport is not enough, but the how is not easy. And we should not think, like, we're doing it. And there's no other industry that's nailed it. I mean, there's $8 billion spent in DEI efforts in corporate America for no gain. So this isn't easy work, but who better than us to kind of be the Black sheep, the underdog, say that we get our story, and it was crap up till now. And we want to take this and be, you know, inspirational, informative, educational, and just keep stepping it. Because even when we're federally legal, this is still hyper-local. And local people should expect companies to be responsible with their resources. And not even just responsible, like, how do we think that planet's resources should be used? What is the story we want to tell the countries who are thinking about this? How can they have frameworks, not just listen to the business interests that come in and say, hey, you should do this, but have a framework where here is what it looks like to benefit people, you know, people, planet, community. And there's a lot of ways to do it. So it's really our honor to get to, you know, dig into this and be nimble and humble ourselves and work with amazing people.
And imagine an industry like cannabis and cannabis doing good companies that have the ability to inspire and lead other industries, right? We talk about cannabis doing good. We're talking about companies doing good, and consumers are going to increasingly demand it. And so we know that it's going to have a return on the company. So when we're talking about the benefit, we're talking about huge societal impact. We're talking about local community benefit. We're talking about changing the way that we move and discuss and operate our businesses based on racial justice. And we're also talking about impacting the growth of the business and impacting the bottom line, which is equally important if you're running your own business. So we believe you can do good and be abundant. We want to be living examples of that. And we know that the industry can demonstrate that you can do good and be abundant, and hopefully then inspire other industries to very quickly follow suit.
It's extremely meaningful work, and it's nice to hear that there are companies in this space who are walking the walk rather than just talking the talk. And I think with that heightened awareness that we saw last year, we saw a lot of talking the talk and not a lot of follow-up. So it's, as you said, seeing these companies actually commit to this and actually really work to be better is very, very, very powerful. And I know that recently you both hosted a mentorship workshop. I'm wondering if you have any other events like that coming up that we can highlight right now so that our listeners can know where they can learn more about the work that you're doing, how to get involved. Do you have anything like that coming up?
Well, I will say very excitingly, we have spent, you know, COVID was challenging for our business. We had tremendous space and opportunity to reflect and to grow. We founded the Cannabis Impact Fund last year with the help of Sensible Colorado being our fiscal sponsor. But it also allowed us to go back and really ensure, are we making this work the most accessible that it can be? And so imminently, in a matter of weeks, Cannabis Doing Good is relaunching its website. And one of the premier things that we're offering is a racial equity self-assessment for businesses. It's something we've been working on probably since our beginning 6 years ago, but very actively in the last 18 months. And we worked with experts across our industry, like Hood Incubator and Minorities for Medical Marijuana, as well as experts from without, outside of our industry. And the racial equity self-assessment is really geared towards measuring companies in five key areas, such as HR, such as marketing and communications, company commitments, community engagement, policy and advocacy, and giving companies scores in each of those areas to see how they're doing. And the assessment is meant to be a tool to call companies in, right? This is a reason it's a self-assessment, is that the only people who get that score are the company and us. And the idea is that they can then see how they're doing in these key areas and then move through the Cannabis Doing Good ecosystem to participate in workshops and trainings and classes. We've moved our anti-racism training. We still offer live trainings, but we have filmed it to be able to have digital modules so that it can be more accessible to not only managers, but to all the staff. It could be part of your onboarding or your recruiting. And what that ultimately leads to, what we hope that it leads to, is when you move through our assessment and you take participate in our workshops and our trainings and hopefully become a Cannabis Doing Good member, you will then have the opportunity to apply for the Cannabis Doing Good badge, which is a way to demonstrate to your staff and to your vendors and to your partners, and most of all to your consumers, that you are doing good. This is something that we're just really excited about. But the most accessible thing that someone can do in a matter of weeks is visit the Cannabis Doing Good website and see that we have a whole host of workshops that we're offering for the remainder of the year, and to take the racial equity self-assessment, because we guarantee it's going to be a tool that feels very accessible, and it's going to be educational, and then it tells you how you're doing in these 5 key areas and hopefully provides you some insight on how to do better. When we know better, we'll do better. And I think that's the intention of the racial equity self-assessment.
Ooh, you're good. Good, Courtney Mathis. The only thing I would like to just mention is that because, you know, 97% of the industry is white-owned, that we are rather skewed to white-owned companies because we're seeking to assist folks in anti-racism. The black and brown companies that we know, the indigenous companies that we know, they are focused on it. They're doing it as a nature, a function of their business. So it's like people's dispensary, right? Or Dogwood Botanicals or BIPOC Can or Simply Pure. These folks are doing racial equity in their work. So it's not that they can't take the assessment. It's just that it wasn't really written for them. When they see it, they'll see, oh, yeah, we're doing check, 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 check. But just to put that framing out there, because perspective matters. And there's so many companies, small companies, companies that just started, who are sending us quarterly 1% donations for the Cannabis Impact Fund because they know the historical context of cannabis and they feel it's a privilege to operate in the space and they want to be contributing to the movement for people's liberation outside of our industry. So like Courtney says, we really try lots of avenues to make the right thing the easy thing. And honestly, we know nothing's easy, but we love this stuff. And so we're gonna keep at it and hope our community of cannabis folks and the larger community sees and contributes to us improving all of the time, because we are humble learners every day.
Yes. Yes to that. And so head over to the Cannabis Impact Fund and become a pledge partner or a donor, or just share about us on your socials, and then head over to Cannabis Doing Good in a couple of weeks and join our really fun, completely purpose-driven ecosystem and take the racial equity self-assessment to see how you're doing.
We're so honored to have had you on as our guest today, Kelly and Courtney. And as we've heard from other guests on the show, there was a silver lining in the pandemic in that it did afford us all a little bit more time to work on those things that have been on the back burner or been kind of taking a back seat for the last couple of years. So it's great to hear that you took some time out of the stay-at-home measures and everything else the last year threw at us to work on that website redesign. One more time for our listeners, you can learn more about this important work at thecannabisimpactfund.org and cannabisdoinggood.com. Kelly and Courtney, thank you so much for being with us on the Hoban Minute.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.